The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this past couple of weeks, I've been away teaching retreat at Insight Retreat Center, our retreat center in Santa Cruz. And this last week, Gil and I taught together, and we explored a theme from one of the suttas, a kind of not very frequently explored theme called the Four Resolves. And I thought, that's the topic that I've been thinking about all week, so that's what's here today. So you're going to get a kind of an overview or a summary of this theme. And we can think about our practice in some ways as a journey, as a basically it's a journey into what it means to be a human being. It's an exploration or a path helping us to understand fully what it means to be human. And the spiritual path is often kind of equated with a journey. If we think about a journey often has a destination. We're going somewhere, trying to get somewhere. And it's often helpful to have some direction, some guidance about where you might go and how you might get there. You know, a map is often helpful. And yet a map and an idea of where we're going, you know, isn't quite sufficient if you don't know how to read a map. And so we need some skills. We need to learn some skills for how to follow this map. And also, just being able to follow the map doesn't necessarily, I mean, having a map and looking at it doesn't get you anywhere. And you can have the map, you can know how to read it, you can follow along and say, oh yeah, okay, when I got to there, I would turn left, and then when I got to there, I'd go straight for a little while, and then somebody told me I'd see that thing, and then I'd go there. And you can kind of plan it out in your mind, but never take the first step. And so you have to actually engage. You have the tools, you have some skills, and then you need to engage. You need to walk on the path. And so the journey, our journey into our spiritual practice, our journey into this path that the Buddha points to, it's got a little bit different quality than a journey on a map. In that, you know, a journey on a map, we're typically thinking about getting from here to there. And in a way, our journey with our practice is not about getting from here to there, but it's about really understanding what it is to be here. So it's kind of a journey from here into here. And yet it's still supportive to have some guidance on how to make that journey. These resolves that the Buddha talked about are you know, kind of what we might call an orientation for a journey. They're it's like, this is the direction to go to fully get here. This is the direction. And so that it's kind of like these resolves point us in a direction. They point us towards where we might be headed. And they also are providing some guidance on how to walk that path. So I'll read a little section of this. There are these resolves, the resolve of wisdom, the resolve of truth, the resolve of relinquishment, and the resolve of peace. The word resolve here is also translated as foundation. And so this paragraph also reads, there's this foundation of wisdom, a foundation of truth, a foundation of relinquishment, and a foundation of peace. And so in some ways I see these qualities or these these directions, they kind of are orientations. It's like, yes, wisdom, that's a good direction to go. Yeah, truth, that's a good direction to go. Relinquishment, well, not so sure about that one. Let's think about that one. We'll get to that in a minute. Relinquishment, you know, the way the Buddha talks about it, hopefully by the end of this day, you'll be at least curious about relinquishment being something to explore. And then peace. Yeah, peace, that sounds good. Let's, you know, head that direction. And so they're kind of what we might call resolves or determinations or directions or aspirations even. We could use the word aspiration of where we'd like to head. Where we'd like our minds to be in this moment. Wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. And yet the word foundation also has a sense of, you know, something that is, a place to land, a place to stand, a place to be connected with. And the way that this teaching is taught is that we essentially use these directions and exploring or cultivating this direction towards wisdom, towards truth, towards relinquishment, towards peace, creates this foundation where we're standing on these. We're no longer having to work to create them, but there they are. They are serving us in our journey. And so they move from being aspiration to being kind of more fundamentally connected to our being. So in some ways we can say with this, looking at this, these two words, you know, a resolve towards or a aspiration towards these qualities, and that the movement of aspiring towards these qualities helps take the mind to a place where we are actually the word possessing is a little odd, but it's along those lines where we maybe living. How about that? We are living those qualities. We're living those experiences. And so in some ways we can see that in this journey, where we are going, you know, we get to where we're going by modeling or trying to emulate where we're going in a way. And so the path of our practice reflects where we're going. It reflects the destination. You know, we move towards peace by training for peace. And so the Buddha had actions associated with each of these areas, these resolves. He said we should not neglect wisdom. We should preserve the truth. We should cultivate relinquishment and train for peace. So maybe a kind of a pithy summary here is, if you want to be peaceful, act peacefully, train for peace. So the path that we walk intimately reflects. It's not separate from the goal. And so every moment of our practice, it's like we're deepening more and more into this possibility, the possibility of peace. One of the ways that the freedom from suffering is framed in the Buddhist teaching, release from suffering is peace. And so not neglecting wisdom in the teachings of the Buddha, you know, we have many ideas about wisdom, you know, many ideas about what we think wisdom is, you know, and when there's wisdom about many things, like there's, you know, the word wisdom we often think of as being somehow connected to maybe more being human than having knowledge about something. You know, we wouldn't necessarily say one is, you know, that one who has skill in driving a car has wisdom about driving a car, but perhaps the wisdom in that area might come in terms of recognizing how to, you know, be more cooperative on the road, that there's some wisdom in that. You know, there's many areas of knowledge where we, you know, we feel like, yes, in our culture, it's helpful to gain knowledge about various areas. With respect to wisdom, we often, you know, refer to, you know, relationship sometimes. You know, somebody is wise in relationship when they know how to navigate challenging situations, or, you know, so there's a kind of a sense we have of wisdom, of what it is. I think the word is evocative. The word is evocative of what wisdom is. And for me, the word wisdom, you know, it kind of had a grand feeling to it. It's like it's something really big, you know. It's like when I first started reading about what the Buddha taught and this word wisdom, I thought, yeah, well, okay, maybe someday I'll understand something of wisdom. But, you know, the wisdom the Buddha taught, it was pretty actually specific. You know, he at one point said to his followers, he picked up a handful of leaves in the forest and said, which is greater, the number of leaves I have in my hand or the number of leaves on the trees in the forest? And I can imagine they're kind of like, is this a trick question? The number of leaves in your hand is fewer, you know, the number of leaves in the forest is greater. And he said, just the same, what I know, what I understand is like the leaves in the forest. But what I teach is like the leaves I have in my hand. What I teach is useful, what is useful for helping us to find our way to letting go of suffering. And so this, you know, the wisdom of the Buddhist teaching here is pretty specific. It's about looking at how are we suffering and beginning to understand how that suffering is put together and what might allow it to shift and change and move in the direction of peace. How can the mind shift from being caught and tight and confused to easeful, peaceful? And so the wisdom of the Buddha is it's kind of specific in that way. And yet there's so many different ways it's talked about. You know, even as I began hearing all the various teachings, I thought, oh, I'll never really have the wisdom that the Buddha is talking about. And yet, in practice, what I have seen is that wisdom... Well, let me back up for a second. You know, so many different ways it's described in the teachings. You know, there's one of the classic definitions of wisdom in the Buddhist teaching is understanding the Four Noble Truths, that one who has wisdom understands in the direct experience how these Four Noble Truths work. First of all, that there is suffering, and there's a reason that suffering arises. It's not random. And that there's a possibility for that suffering to be released, and that there's a path, a way to the release from that suffering. That's one definition of wisdom in the Buddhist teaching. And you know, we might think about that as just something to believe in or something to you know, think about. But over and over in the Buddhist teachings around wisdom, he said, this isn't just something to think about. It's not just a good idea. It's something that you have to practice. So this is that, you know, so this is like the map. The Four Noble Truths are kind of like the map. And then we have to engage. We have to practice. We have to explore. What does it mean? What does suffering mean? And this is where, again, the actions that we take. The Buddha encouraged us to understand suffering. He didn't in the sutta say, beat yourself up because you're suffering, or feel like you're a failure because you're suffering. He said, understand it. Get to know it. Open to the experience and begin to see what happens. The Second Noble Truth points to suffering is not random. It happens because of conditions. It's put together because of conditions. Understand those conditions. As the mind begins to understand the conditions of how suffering is put together, and there's conditions both in the world and in our minds. You know, there's stuff happening out there, and there's our mind responding to that, reacting to it, having ideas, views, opinions about it. And, so there's those things that kind of come together to interact, and then suffering arises if there's contraction or tightness or holding or clinging about it. The Buddha pointed to this tightening around what's happening. You know, what's arising right now shouldn't be happening. That in the moment, what's already happening, kind of contracting around it, is the creation of the heart of tightness as opposed to the heart of openness and receptivity. That's not to say that there's things that are happening in the world that should not be happening. You know, there's so much injustice in this world. Just, you know, look at the newspaper. It just shows just how much injustice there is in the world. The strong racism that's happening, especially in our country these days, around especially our young black men being killed by police officers. There's that aspect of what's happening in the world, and then there's bombings, and then there's the simple. It's the human suffering of aging, of sickness, of death. There's so much happening out there. And it's not to say that in meeting that we don't try to move in a direction of alleviating suffering, of helping people to understand how they're caught and their behavior is creating harm. I think this is part of the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching, that he grounds his teaching in non-harming. Harming creates suffering for ourselves, for others, for both. And so the grounding in the teaching of non-harming is kind of the base for this teaching of wisdom. And so we engage with exploring what does it mean to contract? You know, the idea, this shouldn't be happening. I think what happens in our mind is we think if we don't think this shouldn't be happening, if we don't contract around injustice in the world, then we wouldn't do anything. You know, we think that if we think we shouldn't feel like this shouldn't be happening, then it must mean we think it should be happening, and that's not the middle way. You know, the middle way is actually more like, oh, this is happening. This creates suffering. What can we do to alleviate suffering? So the movement of the heart that meets the world that's in so much pain, rather than a contracted heart, this is where the wisdom points us. Rather than the contracted heart, it is a heart of compassion. Wisdom and compassion. When the heart is not contracted, wisdom and compassion act in the world. And so, you know, this idea that we might have that the belief, you know, it shouldn't be like this, that letting go of that belief, of that contraction, it shouldn't be like this, means that we would just like sit back and say, oh, you know, okay, no problem. People are suffering out there. It's like, oh, well, that's their thing. You know, it's like, no, that's not what happens as the heart releases that contraction. it releases the contraction and transforms the relationship to suffering from being one of aversion and hostility to one of compassion and action through compassion. And so this is some of the exploration. My analogy for wisdom these days is that of an enzyme that one of our Sangha friends here today introduced me to this analogy. Thank you so much. And wisdom kind of takes what's out there and what's in here and begins to transform. It's like the enzyme of wisdom begins to support the release and the letting go of that contraction. But it's almost like, you know, it allows the enzyme will allow the dissolving of what's unwholesome. But that enzyme also like shores up and supports the strength of heart and the courage of heart and the compassion of heart to act in the face of suffering. And so there's this beautiful natural process as we don't neglect wisdom. And the word not neglecting wisdom is interesting. Neglecting means kind of just forgetting about, you know, leaving to the side. And not neglecting can be as simple as just keeping it close, you know, reminding that this is an important piece. And so not neglecting wisdom might be as simple as just reminding ourselves that in a contracted heart, the responsiveness is limited. Or it might be a simple thing, and this is one thing I discovered actually in my own practice. It's like this idea that the wisdom is so huge, and how can I possibly penetrate this wisdom? Well, if you just take one piece of that wisdom of the Buddha, understand suffering, just that piece. Understanding here means not thinking about, but meeting with mindfulness, beginning to see how it's put together, where the conditions in the world are leading to it, where the conditions in the heart are leading to it. What is the experience of suffering? What is that contracted heart? Just that movement to understand suffering from an experiential perspective. That little piece is enough to start with. When I started my practice, I read some books and didn't understand much of what I read about the Buddha's teaching. And yet one little piece I got was something along these lines. It's like, well, see if you can understand your anger. You know, the anger was the biggest piece that I was being so ruled by. You know, it was creating so much dysfunction in my life. I was unable to function. And I got this book, and I didn't understand much of it, but I got this one little tiny gem out of it, and it was like, well, see what happens for a little while if you try recognizing that anger's happening. Just open to that. Know what it's like. Know the experience of anger instead of letting the mind run away in thoughts about it. Just see what happens if you know what it is to be a human being that's angry. That one little nugget, little tiny nugget, it's like that one little nugget connects you to the entirety of the teaching. And if you just practice with that one little nugget, and whatever it is for you, I mean, there's so many different ways that wisdom is expressed. If there's one way that it's expressed that resonates for you and you think, yeah, that makes sense, I'd like to practice that. That might be cultivating the quality of love. You know, bringing the quality of love into your heart, reminding yourself that one of the things the Buddha taught was, you can search the whole world and you will not find anyone more worthy of your love than yourself. And so turning that little wisdom, what might happen if you start from there and begin to see if you can truly love yourself. Whatever wisdom that resonates for you to put into practice, start there. And it will start to connect you to so much more. It begins to soften the heart, open the heart. It's that enzyme at work. And so not neglecting wisdom leads us in a way, maybe not even in a way, in some ways I think what the wisdom is, the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching is a pointing to a truth. It's a pointing to a kind of a beacon of where we might be headed. The truth in the teachings has so many different, has a couple different meanings, and one of them is simply, what is the truth of this moment? Can we open to the truth of this moment? The truth of this moment being simply, this body and mind are receiving experience and processing, knowing that there's body sensations, there's sound, there's sight, there's smell, there's thoughts, there's emotions, all happening right now in the present moment. No one can the truth or the experience of what's happening here and now in a kind of bare sense, you know, just the actual sense of what's being experienced in this moment. That is a kind of truth. Nobody can deny that that there's an experience of pressure here right now and sound and thoughts arising right now. Now, the content of those thoughts, you know, this is a lot where we get caught. You know, the content of those thoughts, our views, our beliefs, the content of those thoughts, well, may or may not be true. But the fact that a thought is arising in the moment is a truth. The fact that a belief is arising in the moment is a truth. Not the idea or the content, but just the simple, bare fact of experience here and now. This is the truth that the Buddha actually asked us to explore. What is this truth? And where is it that extra gets added into that truth? You know, concepts and views and ideas, beliefs get overlaid on this experience, and then we relate to those beliefs, those concepts, those views as if they were true. And so the Buddha pointed us to what he said, preserving the truth. And preserving the truth, he says, yeah, you know, when there's faith in something or a belief in something, there's two situations that might be present there. He said, there's the faith, and then the thing that you have faith in might be true or it might not be true. There's a kind of a reflective acceptance of a view, and that view might be true or it might not be true. And he suggested that preserving the truth means that when you have a sense of something that you believe in or have faith in or have a sense of, oh, this view, I accept this view and will work with this view to orient some of my life. He suggested that we preserve the truth by not saying, this alone is true, everything else is wrong, but, this is what I believe. This is belief. Belief is happening right now. This view is happening right now. Then what we start to see is when we cling to something we believe or cling to a view as if it is the only truth, there's suffering around that. It's not that we have to say the view is useless, but we can use that view and begin to investigate, oh, is this view leading me in the direction of ease and peace? Is it leading me in the direction of non-harming? Is it leading me in the direction of concord and connection, of an open heart? Or is it leading me in the direction of contraction, suffering? So, you know, looking at that, again, coming back to the wisdom of we're headed towards, if we're oriented towards a heart of non-contraction, then when the heart is contracted, we explore that. Allow that enzyme of wisdom to begin to transform it. And so preserving the truth is both about allowing ourselves to meet the moment and beginning to recognize where there's extra things added in that might kind of be a filter or a perspective that limits us from actually receiving what's here and now. And it's so amazing, actually, how even a very simple perspective or view or agenda, even an agenda, can limit what we receive, what we take in. It shapes our consciousness. It shapes our mind to have a view or belief. There's a simple story from kind of recent psychological research that demonstrates the power of this. I've told this story before, so some of you have heard this, but I hope you'll forgive me for repeating it because it's such a helpful thing to see how this works. So this research study, was about this factor of mind called selective attention, that certain agendas of our mind will select things out of the environment to pay attention to and ignore other things. They wanted to see just how potent this factor of mind is, this capacity of mind to select. And so they had this video. They asked people to watch a video, and it was people playing basketball, and they asked them to count the number of times a basketball passed between the people in the white shirts. And they most of the people, you know, could accurately, after the end of the video, report, yes, this many times the basketball passed between the people in the white shirts. And then researchers asked, or sometimes a person who was in the study asked or said something like, was there like a gorilla in that video? And indeed, there had been a guy in a gorilla suit that had walked out into the middle of the basketball court and stopped there for a second, you know, kind of dancing around, and then walked off. And it was like really obvious, you know, if you look at the video, it's like there's no way you cannot see the gorilla. The guy in the gorilla suit, there's no way you can't see it. If you are looking for the gorilla, if you have an orientation or an agenda to focus on something else, you might not see the gorilla. And in fact, I think it was something like 60% of the people watching this video did not see the gorilla. And then, you know, that's not so surprising because of this function of mind, right? It naturally, in a way, kind of narrows down. It's a useful function when we're focused on something to be able to screen other things out. It's a useful factor of our mind. But the kind of telling part of this study to me was that they went on to say that of the people that didn't see the gorilla, you know, when they played the video back and it's like glaringly obvious that the gorilla is there, some, maybe 30 or 40% of those people said, that's got to be a different video. I would have seen the gorilla. And, you know, this is the power of our belief that we are receiving accurately information. This is a simple agenda they had given people, a very simple agenda that oriented them to look at this video in a particular way. And many people just did not see that guy in the gorilla suit. But the idea that I would have seen the gorilla, you know, my sight, my eyes, like we trust, we believe that we know everything we're seeing is what's out there. And so this study to me really points to the way, that's a simple agenda. Look how it shaped consciousness to not see that. It's like something completely excluded. And so when we have a view, when we have an agenda, when we have a contraction of heart, we're not taking in all that's there. And so, you know, part of this exploration would be, okay, recognizing, yes, it's hard not to operate with views. And so I have to acknowledge that if somebody else sees something from a different perspective, I'm probably missing something. So that there's that kind of humility about the truth. And then relinquishment, cultivating relinquishment. What the Buddha talks about relinquishing here is greed, aversion, and delusion. And as we begin to explore, you know, with some degree of curiosity, what it means to be a human being, and we see how suffering works, and we see that that contractedness, greed, aversion, and delusion are, factors of mind that lead us towards that constriction, towards not being able to fully see what's going on. And so as we begin to be curious about wisdom and truth, as we don't neglect wisdom and preserve the truth, it leads us to kind of the movement of heart to, well, actually what I see, it's not so much a doing. My understanding of relinquishment is not that we have to do it. It's not like I have to say, yes, I will let go of greed, aversion, and delusion. I wish I could. I wish I could do that. I wish I could say, yes, mind, stop being greedy. Yes, mind, stop being aversive. Yes, mind, be completely clear about what's going on. I don't have that power. I don't have that much like control over the mind. Because the mind is conditioned by so many things. It's conditioned by past events, by how we were raised by our families, our teachers, things that happened to us, the weather. There's so much that goes into conditioning who we are. That the momentum of the way we've been conditioned to respond to the world, you know, it's like we didn't, you know, we didn't do this greed, aversion, and delusion in a vacuum. You know, we were born into a world, a culture where, we were encouraged in many ways to cling, to crave. You know, our culture is one of valuing consumption. And so, you know, we're born not, I don't think we're born completely as a blank slate by any means, but, you know, the we're put into this condition and our brains are designed to kind of, you know, shore up what seems to be important in our environment. And if, you know, everyone around you seems to believe that getting what you want is going to make you happy, then that kind of activity of mind is what's encouraged. And you know, there's this saying, neurons that fire together, wire together, you know, so the activities of, get what you want, that'll make you happy. That belief that you know, having things will make you happy is so pervasive in our culture that we, you know, we do it. You know, it's like we're not given any other information really to begin with. And, you know, it kind of goes along with our orientation to find or have little moments of ease or peace in our experience. I think our organism is oriented towards well-being in so many ways. And yet, if the information we're given is that well-being will result from having what you want, you know, that's all that we know, and that's what we do, and we get these little moments of well-being as we get something. It's like, oh yeah, whoo, got that thing. Huh. I can relax for a moment. And then, you know, how long does that last? And so the lack of well-being resurfaces, and we're off again trying to find something to alleviate that. And the training we've gotten keeps us kind of spiraling in that direction. It's a very natural, you know, it's very natural that how we are trained is what we will do. And so much of what the practice is about is watching the conditioning of the mind at work, watching how we move towards getting what we want, and seeing that it's not that satisfying. It's not ultimately that satisfying. And maybe the question begins to arise, is there a deeper kind of happiness? Is there a way to actually, you know, find a peace that's not dependent on getting things and getting rid of things? And this is the question that the Buddha started his journey with. Is it possible? And his discovery, the wisdom he discovered of it is greed, aversion, and delusion that keep us from a deeper kind of peace. And so as we start to discover this, there's a natural, that wisdom, to me, again, the enzyme of wisdom is a natural movement in the mind to a letting go of the things that keep us from well-being. This relinquishment begins to happen very naturally. Much of the time, we can't do the relinquishment. But what we can do is meet the suffering. We can open to that and then allow the enzyme of wisdom to begin to support the release of the greed, aversion, and delusion, and to that enzyme also strengthens love and compassion and wisdom and equanimity and a generosity of heart and a kindness and a movement towards connection and alleviating suffering and non-harming. And so this practice of relinquishment, I mean, it's not that of giving up everything. We don't give up action in this relinquishment. In fact, our actions become more potent, more powerful when they're shaped by wisdom and compassion. And as we allow that enzyme of wisdom to lead us more deeply to the truth, that relinquishment begins to naturally unfold. One of the states that remains is peace. And again, you know, we maybe have some ideas about peace. An idea that peace means, oh, maybe we think peace means, you know, sitting without doing anything. And peace means non-action. Again, you know, we have so many beliefs and views about what the path is. I was talking to somebody at this retreat recently and you know, pointing to just coming into the truth of this moment, just coming into knowing this body, this experience of body and mind. And she said, I don't want that. It sounds so, you know, dry, or she wasn't quite, you know, it's like, And I said, well, what do you think it means to come into that? And it was along the lines of, well, it means that, you know, I won't care. Or, you know, I won't feel. And, you know, sometimes the way that our minds take in some of these words, that's a way that we might interpret what would happen if we followed these teachings. And yet from my own experience of just, you know, the little path, the little way I am along this path, is that the movement to actually landing in what's really happening here and now doesn't create the conditions for not caring or being inactive or just, you know, checked out. It's not a piece that's removed from the world. It actually creates the conditions for deeper caring, a deeper connection, a more active response to the world. And so my own sense of what does it mean to be fully free of greed, aversion, and delusion? I don't know what it means. I haven't experienced that state that the Buddha talks about of you know, complete liberation. And yet tastes of it I've had. Tastes of when the mind lets go of the way that it's holding on to something tight and contracted, and feeling how the heart opens and connects and wants to move towards supporting, releasing suffering. And so I have a confidence, a faith. My faith is thus. I have a faith that this practice leads in the direction where I don't know what it might mean to be fully free of greed, aversion, and delusion, to be completely released from greed, aversion, and delusion, but I have confidence that it's a place of action and compassion. You look at the Buddha in the suttas, and he's not, well, if he had sat in a cave, this book wouldn't be here. So he acted, he taught, he conversed with kings and helped them to understand how to lead their kingdoms peacefully. He talked to householders about how to navigate marital quarrels. He talked to lepers about freedom. He tried to stop a water war in his kingdom. This was not a passive person once he freed his heart and mind. He was in the world. He was acting. And so I hold that, you know, that model, that possibility that freedom means. Maybe it means becoming the best human being I can be. So a few minutes for questions or comments, if there's any. We have a few minutes. Yeah. Oh, hang on a sec. Why don't you pass the mic back to him, and you start, and you can do the second question. So would you just pass the second mic back?
Well, it's just a comment. I don't know how relevant it is, but 20 years ago, I was taking classes at Foothill College. There was a computer science teacher who was very into Buddhism. I was often in using Buddhist illustrations or ideas from Buddhism to illustrate what he considered very good programming design. Okay. And in fact, he retired in 98 and moved to India. But I remember there being a student in one of the classes who wanted to take the beginning course and the advanced course simultaneously, and he wouldn't let him do it. And the student asked why he couldn't, and his answer was, "Do you understand the difference between wisdom and knowledge?" Hmm. And it was from there, with the Buddhist references, that he explained why he wasn't going to let him do that.
Yeah. You know, this is actually a point one of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, talks about, the journey of our path being one of first you know, it's like we're naturalists. We're kind of moving in the world and engaged in a scientific discovery. And our first path, our first exploration is gathering data. We just start to meet our experience. And from there, that data gathering, very naturally, the mind begins to pull patterns together and understand something about what's happening. So there's some knowledge and a little bit of wisdom. And then that wisdom flowers into a kind of an experiential understanding, a kind of a foundation, rather than, you know, something we have to think about or put together. So there's some kind of connection there. Yeah. Yeah. Should have a green light.
So what I liked, I just wanted to make the comment that I liked what you had to say in today's speaking. It has been very helpful in kind of showing me that I'm on my path. I've been kind of asking the universe for answers as far as confirmation that I'm on the right path for, you know, the things I'm starting to kind of go toward. And, you know, I heard a lot of keywords and ideas that have been really, like I said, confirming and, you know, life-affirming for me. So I just wanted to express gratitude for that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad it was supportive. Thank you. Yeah. It's off, yeah.
Thanks very much for the talk. So I'm working on changing my response to becoming aware of aversion. Can you talk a bit more about the process of what happens when you notice that there's aversion and then wanting to open the heart up in order to kind of let that pass and take the suffering with it?
Yeah, it's a slow process. My experience around it is that the first, there's a lot of exploration around essentially a different relationship with the aversion. First means a willingness to allow it, watch it, meet it, not to resist it or push it away, but really to open to it. And so essentially what starts to happen is that we are cultivating a friendly, kind relationship to our experience, including aversion. And that friendly, kind relationship creates a different container almost. It creates a different experience of the aversion. We're no longer quite so caught by it and ruled by it. I think some of the difficulty with aversion is that we find ourselves, you know, keep coming back to need to do, need to fix, need to change. And this this relationship of, well, okay, let's see what it's like, you know, to be with that aversion. One of the things that happens there is that we feel the suffering of it very clearly. We feel the suffering of it. And that's where the enzyme of wisdom actually starts to work, is it begins to kind of dissolve the things that create the conditions for that contraction around the aversion to be put into place. I mean, sometimes aversion has, you know, what we sometimes might think is, okay, there's aversion, I need to, like, get rid of the whole thing, you know, put it all aside. But that aversion is constructed around, you know, one of the things that might be constructed around is a wish to be safe, a wish to be happy and have health and safety. And so if we think we have to get rid of the whole thing, it's like that part of the system that is, you know, orienting around safety and well-being and happiness, it's like that the aversion is contracted around that. You can't throw out the whole thing. Because that wish for safety, happiness is a strength of our being. And so what we have to do is kind of allow the wisdom of enzyme to do its work and dissolve the misunderstanding and the clinging and leave the strength and leave the wisdom. Because so often when we a lot of what happens with our reactivity is that there's the, you know, the wish to be safe, for instance, and there's, you know, the reality that, you know, say you're in a, you know, an airplane, you know, 35,000 feet in the air, and the air, you know, it starts to crash. It's like, it's out of control. You know, anger in that situation is a natural response, and yet there's not much we can do. You know, it's like, and so what this enzyme of wisdom does partly is it recognizes that the reactivity, the aversion between these, like this conflict between wanting safety and out of control, it begins to stretch so that we can be have the open heart that both owns that truth and that strength and that wish. Maybe it's more the wish for the well-being of the organism, for our own well-being, and understands. And, you know, I don't have total control. And that the heart that's open to both of those kind of begins to navigate in a different way, not so much through trying to deny that it's out of control, you know, or to try to figure out, you know, it's like, it's out of control. What am I doing wrong? How did I get myself in this situation? It's like, it's life. So it begins to, you know, that enzyme of wisdom begins to open us to both of those. And then there's kind of something mysterious that begins to happen in navigating it. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's like, well, we're going down with the plane and, you know, that's what's happening. And we need to stop. So, thank you.